So tonight's talk is different than I've been doing for the last 3 months or so, in that it isn't based on a particular sutta. It's more based, as I said in the email I sent out, I've been over the last 3 months or so, 3.5 months, teaching in the morning at the 8 o'clocks and taking little bits out of various books, in particular three books. By Kim McCarthy and Sylvia Wurstein and Sharon Salzberg. These are all related to the topic of loving kindness. And so it struck me that it would be kind of interesting to sort of see if I could sort of gather all that stuff together into a talk. And I have sort of headlines, and I'm just going to work my way through the series of different thoughts. Hence the name. I call this the Thoughts on Loving Kindness. Here's the top level thoughts, and I'll explore each of these to a greater or lesser extent in the next hour. So, top number one, and this is always the number one of everything I've ever involved with it when it comes to loving kindness, and that's important to start with. And I'll talk quite about that. And how practice how we live in the world is another topic. Removing ill will instead of adding in kindness. This is a different way to look at it. It's worth looking at. And mindfulness and metta are two aspects of the same practice. I kept coming across this in all the different things I was reading and in my own thoughts and practice. And finally, dealing with loss, which is not something I ever thought about in terms of metta before I started exploring all these different commentaries, but I think it's actually a quite interesting place to look at. So those are the headlines. So I want to start in the importance of self by reading something from Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness. And she's talking about in quite broad terms about the practice of metta. The practice of metta, uncovering the force of love that can uproot fear, anger, and guilt, begins with befriending ourselves. The foundation of metta practice is to know how to be our own friend. According to the Buddha, you can search through the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are yourself, and that person is not to be found anywhere. You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserves your love and affection. How few of us embrace ourselves in this way? With metta practice, we uncover the possibility of truly respecting ourselves. We discover, as Walt Whitman put it, "I am larger and better than I thought. I did not think I held much goodness." Directly seeing the natural radiance of our minds reteaches us our own loveliness. To allude to the phrase in the Zen tradition, this is our original face before we were born. Before we were born into identification with a separate, limited self. Recognizing your own power to love points us directly to recognizing this primordial radiance. Confidence in our innate potential to be loving human beings empowers the cultivation of metta. Our potential to love is very real and is somehow not destroyed, no matter what we experience, all the mistakes we might make, all the times when we are not in reaction, all of the times we have caused pain. All of the times you have suffered. Throughout everything, our potential to love remains intact and pure. Through practicing meditation and in daily life, we cultivate this potential. Love joins with attention as partners in healing ourselves and our world. This is such lovely language, and she's basically pointing to how powerful metta is, how powerful both the practice, the formal practice of loving kindness, and I'll talk about that some, and also just living a life filled with loving kindness. how powerful that is a healing force for ourselves and for the world around us. And it's just what she's getting at is it's really difficult to love towards others, to have thoughts of love and kindness towards others if we don't feel it in ourselves, if we don't feel, if we can't love ourselves first. It's like it has to begin here. This is Kevin McCart's thoughts on this. Oops, I got the wrong page here. actually, I have the wrong book. That's why I have the wrong page. Too many books. I got too many books. Okay, Kevin, once again, this is what Kevin McCarthy has to say. When it comes to loving others, it makes sense that if our feelings towards ourselves are unkind, any effort to be kind to others will be adulterated. These efforts will always be colored by some form of neediness. These efforts will always, either we will be trying to get validation from others or trying to compensate for our lack of self-worth by being extra good. These external efforts will never succeed as long as our inner world feels barren. It's a very barren feeling that makes us think we don't deserve love. We look inside and see anxiety and sadness, worry and stress, irritation and judgment. Then we equate feeling bad with being bad. In this formulation, if we are bad, then clearly we don't deserve love. I love this. I love this. It's like, we equate feeling bad with being bad. That somehow when we're not perfect, we're not just rosy and smiley all the time, we're bad. There's something wrong with us. As opposed to, oh, I'm a human being and sometimes I have ups and sometimes I have downs. You know, I experience the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. And then Kevin on here. Instead of self-judgment, metta encourages us to care for ourselves simply because we are suffering. Let me read that again. Instead of self-judgment, metta encourages us to care for ourselves simply because we are suffering. To be kind to the sadness and worry. To be gentle with the judgment and irritation. We actually give love to those very feelings. Rather than fighting with our inner life, we open to it with acceptance and compassion. Just the shift in view, in the point of view. It's like, yeah, it's okay that I'm worried sometimes. It's okay that sometimes I'm not smiley and happy all the time. It's all okay. And that being able to say it's okay is the beginning of being able to actually love yourself, because you see that you're just a human being who needs love like anybody else. So, and it's because we all want to feel loved. There's not. I've never met anyone who didn't want to feel love, who didn't want to experience being loved by others. But if we're not careful, we turn that into, I need love. I have to have love. And we start acting out in ways that cause suffering for ourselves and suffering for others. We turn it into desire as opposed to just, well, of course, I'm a human being. It's that it's a thing of sort of a level, a quality level thing going on there that we have to be very careful about. Kevin goes on in another section here. Now he wants to talk about practicing metta in the world. In other words, there's this formal practice of metta, where we're in sitting practice, and we're repeating the formal phrases. And this is a very powerful way to sort of tune into love, into the thoughts and feelings of loving kindness, both ourselves, and then eventually as we progress in that teaching, start expressing thoughts of loving kindness for others as well. Very powerful practice. But how we live in the world has to begin with how we live in the world. If we only think those thoughts when we're sitting in a formal practice, and the rest of the time, who knows what's going on, it isn't going to work, because like we can't sit and practice all the time. Most of the time, we're just living in the world. And we have to start there. This is another section from Kevin's book. In the Majjhima Nikaya, the shorter discourse in Gosinga, what Ananda heard is that the Buddha went to visit three monks who we would say were on retreat, that is, practicing silent meditation together for an extended period. This was a very common thing. The monks would go off into the forest, sometimes alone, sometimes in a very small group, and then they'd do intensive practice. This is what the Buddha kept encouraging them to do. The Buddha found them in a protected forest where he quizzed them on how they were getting along and how their practice was progressing. The senior of these monks, Aruda, was another cousin of the Buddha's, and he was the one who answered the Buddha's questions. The first thing the Buddha asks is if they are getting alms food. You know, as a monastic, they weren't allowed to grow food or store food or carry food more than miles, so they were totally dependent on the people around them for their actual daily meal, their one meal a day. Since this meant that even when on feet in the forest, they had to be living near enough to the village of some sort that they could walk there in the morning, get food, and come back without using up too much time, since their main activity was meditating. Kevin asked this really interesting question. Why would the Pali Canon require this little detail, one that has no direct relevance to the teachings? So he thinks, right? I believe it's to show that the Buddha was concerned about his followers' welfare on every level, the physical as well as the spiritual. If love is caring, then this question reveals the love and compassion he had for his monks. First, he wants to know if they're getting fed. Other questions can follow later. So, and then in the Majjhima Nikaya, in this actual discourse, this is what happens next. So the Buddha's asked them, how are things going, guys? And this is Aruda's answer. Venerable sir, as to that, I think thus. It is a gain for me. It is a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the holy life. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards those venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I consider, why should I not set aside what I would do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, venerable sir, but one in mind. The other two monks agree, absolutely. This is how, sir, we are living in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing.
Nice. And I want to point out a couple of things here that are really, I think, important. And the first one is where he says, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these other venerable ones wish to do? This is loving kindness in action in the world. This is like, oh, I don't always have to get my way. I can sort of go along with what others want and be with them and share things with them.
Barry, it
Is
seems
something
like
happening?
something
Can you,
changed.
are you not hearing me, Kathleen? Can other people hear me?
Yeah.
Jonah, can you hear me okay? Yeah. So it's just you, Kat.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, somehow or other it seems I might be disconnected. Hold on.
Can you hear me? Okay, fine. Just some my Bluetooth thing sort of did something weird there. Who knows? So let me go back to what I was saying. This sentence here, I consider, why should I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? This is like loving kindness in action. This is like, oh, I don't always have to just do what I want to do. I can, if I'm living with other, in connection with other beings and others, and if I'm not living totally alone all the time, which is essentially how all of us are, we're always living with other, in connection with other beings at work and in with our families and who knows, I mean, all kinds of different situations, our sangha. Then just doing what the others wish to do is sometimes a real act of loving kindness. Just that. And I don't mean you should let yourself become a doormat, which is the other extreme of like just always going along with everybody else and never saying what you want or standing up or doing anything other than just going along with what others. There's a balance you have to find here, right? But it's important that we find that balance. Another thing that he's saying is I love that he says that he performs acts of loving kindness, physically, verbally, and mentally, both openly and privately. In other words, sometimes it's obvious to the others that he's acting from a place of kindness, and a lot of the time it's just that's where he's coming from. He doesn't need for them to say how wonderful this. He doesn't need anything from these other people at all. He just acts because that's his natural tendencies to act from a place of loving kindness. And that's seems also really important to me that remember that the near enemy of loving kindness is desire, wanting something. And if all the time you're acting out of loving kindness so that other people will say how wonderful you are, there's something missing there. Okay, and that's why he emphasizes acting both openly and privately. And then I love this phrase, review each other with kindly eyes. If we could just do that, if we could just in the as we live in the world, view other beings with kindly eyes. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? Ah. Now I want to just, I finally got back to Sylvia Wursting. This is, we've seen how establishing equanimity in the mind creates the conditions for the arising of profound wisdom that in turn promotes kindness as the natural empathic response. Then she says, the converse is also true. The expression of kindness establishes equanimity that in turn sustains wisdom, which is always consoling. So she's saying that this isn't just about loving kindness, because loving, acting in this way, thinking in this way, speaking in this way, brings the mind to a calmer place, to a place of equanimity, because you're not contending with others all the time. You're reaching a place of equanimity simply by expressing and putting out the energy of loving kindness. And I think that's quite a wise thought. How much of the time do we end up sort of caught up in, not being full of loving kindness and that throwing us off being equanimous, being balanced, being steady, being caught up in the the world and the craziness of things. Okay. So now there's the next one of these on my list. I just found this was interesting. This is removing ill will instead of adding loving kindness. So sometimes, you know, when we think about metta, about loving kindness practice, as trying to sort of be more full of loving kindness all the time. And it might be, for some of us, you know, at least some of us, some of the time, more skillful to sort of flip that over. And here's a couple of lines from the Metta Sutta. And this is where the Buddha's gone through, in sort of halfway through the Metta Sutta, where he's already said that we need to, you know, we have thoughts of loving kind towards others all the time. And then he says, let none deceive another, despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. So this is stating, this is the opposite of loving kindness. And sometimes, and this is a point that Kevin makes in his book, sometimes it might be easier to just try not to be so full of not loving kindness, to try and see ill will when it arises and not act from ill will, as opposed to trying to, you know, amp up the loving kindness. Let's just turn down the ill will. Right. Get my books organized here again. Right, so this is he's talking about another sutta. He says, the theme of the sutta is the challenging to maintaining non-ill will in the face of attacks, verbal or physical. Here we see one of the rhetorical teaching strategies of the Buddha. He seems to understand that a positive declaration of love everyone can trigger grasping. So instead points us towards letting go of the obstructions to love. So instead of trying to express more love, look at what's in the way of that love and just letting those things go. This is just an interesting way to look at it. In this way, rhetoric mirrors the teachings themselves. Letting go is the path to freedom. So he tells us that we have to let go what we have to let go of. Instead, he had set out some ideal to strive for. It would just give people something else to chase after. And again, the implication is that our natural state when rid of negative qualities is a positive one. That when hatred is removed, love is naturally revealed. When greed subsides, generosity is spontaneous. This is an essential Buddhist concept, that our fundamental human nature is loving and wise. The work of Buddhist practice is to abandon the things that obscure these qualities in us. It's like flipping the whole story on its ear. And instead of worrying about being full of loving kindness all the time, just see if you can, through mindfulness, see when ill will arises and do away with that, and loving kindness will just naturally arise anyway, because that's our nature, is to be full of loving kindness. It's just, I like the, it's a beautiful way to think of things, because it sort of shifts. And then another view of this, of this idea. This is once again Sharon Salzberg. This is another image I really like. She's talking about the practicing and how sometimes, you know, especially when we're doing formal practice of loving kindness, when we're repeating the phrases, sometimes it's like, oh God, these phrases are just so boring. So dull. I'm not, what am I doing? You know, we start really questioning ourselves, and the practice becomes kind of dry. So what she's suggesting is very similar to what Kevin was saying here. In practicing metta, we do not have to make a certain feeling happen. Ah, so here we are again. We don't have to sort of make this sweet feeling be there all the time, right? In fact, during the practice, we see that we feel differently at different times. Any momentary emotional tone is far less relevant than the considerable power of intention we harness as we say these phrases. As we repeat, may I be happy, may all beings be happy, we are planting seeds by forming this powerful intention in the mind. The seed will bear fruit in its own time. So she's speaking about the second noble truth, right intention, wholesome intention. If we can just practice without any expectation that some sweet, overwhelming feeling is going to arise, that nothing is going to arise, our mind will still get distracted and crazy just like it always does. But if we continue to practice as best we can and keep repeating the phrases, we're planting seeds that will come at a later time. And then she gives this great story. When I was practicing metta intensively in Burma, at times when I repeated the phrases, I would picture myself in a wide open field planting seeds. Doing metta, we plant the seeds of love, knowing that nature will take its course, and in time, those seeds will bear fruit. Seeds will come to fruition quickly, some slowly, but our work is simply to plant the seeds. Every time we form the intention in the
happiness of others, we are doing our work. We are channeling the powerful energies of our own minds. This is like, I think this is so important. It's like this idea of planting seeds. Like, I love the image. It's like, whenever we're consciously practicing love and kindness, whether it be in a formal practice or just like in our daily life, going, oh, I should try and act more from a place of love and kindness than ill will in this particular situation. You know, just when we wake up to that, when mindfulness has come forward and gone, you know, here's one of those situations where you can act differently. And basically, the whole idea behind metta is simply that the more, oh, am I connected or disconnected again?
Okay, I'm still here. Okay. The whole idea behind metta is simply that we're trying to, as much as possible, fill our minds with thoughts of love and kindness. And in the formal practice, that's all we're doing is we're repeating the phrases, and the phrases have this quality of loving kindness built into the phrases. But just in our daily lives, how often can we just, oh, I can actually practice loving kindness in this situation. And the more often we do that, the more we fill our mind with thoughts of loving kindness, the less room there is for thoughts of ill will. We can only be thinking one thing at a time. The mind can only have one thing going on at once. And if we're putting more and more loving kindness into the mind, there's going to be less and less room for ill will. We're shifting the pattern just by consciously choosing one over the other. It's so simple. I mean, the beauty of this is this simple. If I can just have more thoughts of loving kindness more often, I can have less thoughts of ill will. Ah, this is progress. This is moving in the right direction. And that's all we have to do. Easier said than done, of course. I understand that as well. Right. So now we're back to Sylvia Burstein. This is where mindfulness and metta are two aspects of the same practice. And this is something that I think is actually quite important, that we see that this is true. And I want to read a fair bit from what various people say about this and talk about my personal experiences as well. When I was introduced to MetaPractice, this is Sylvia Boorstein. When I was introduced to MetaPractice 25 years ago, I was thought it was different, not only in technique, but also in goal from mindfulness. In fact, it was, and it still sometimes is presented as an ancillary practice to use in case special needs, such as perilous circumstances, or as a formal ritual ending for a retreat practice, part of the rededication merit. What I have come to believe out of my experience is that mindfulness and metta, although they are associated with different techniques, are, each of them, integral to the practice of the other. I cannot be genuinely mindful, open to moment-to-moment experience, without hesitation or hiding, unless my mind is benevolent, unless I forgive whatever part of my experience arouses distress in me. Indeed, it is the mindful awareness I'm in pain, or someone else is, that causes feeling goodwill to spontaneously arise in me. And I couldn't be seriously practicing metta without paying very careful attention to, being mindful of, whether what I'm wishing matches what I feel. In my experience, it's the repeated direct awareness of how benevolent connection, friendliness, compassion, appreciation liberates my mind from suffering that supports both wisdom and equanimity in me and inspires my determination to stay alert. So what she's getting at is this whole thing that these two practices that externally, I mean, one, you know, mindfulness, we're just watching what's going on in the mind, essentially, and in the body, and metta, which is we're actually choosing to repeat these phrases and keep repeating them, and, you know, sort of fill the mind with thoughts of love and kindness by continuously repeating these phrases. Externally, they look really different. They're two different techniques. But in Buddhist psychology and in Buddhist terminology, there's this thing called citta. And the translation for citta is heart-mind. It's not. It's like there's no separation. There's like in our Western psychological world, there's heart and there's mind. They're in two different places. And in these teachings and in the whole Eastern view of things, there's just heart-mind. It's like heart and mind are both here at the center of our chest. And they're just two separate aspects of the same thing. They're like two sides of the same coin. And we need to understand that because we're trying to balance out through these two practices. In some sense, we're trying to balance out, I feel the need to be more heart-centered today. Oh, maybe I should do metta practice as opposed to doing mindfulness practice today, and vice versa. Might be for a day, or might be like, yeah, I'm just going through a really tough time these days. I think I'll just do metta practice for a while. Or, boy, my life is going great. My mind is clear. I think I'll stick with mindfulness practice and see if I can make it even clearer. And we're trying to find this balance all the time between the two. But they're like two aspects of the same thing. And you can't be practicing metta without being mindful. And you can't practice mindfulness without having an open heart. Oh, wait, they're, like I say, two aspects of the same thing. I want to continue here. This is, again, from Kevin Griffin. If I get the right page here. So this is Kevin saying, same topic. A superficial understanding of meditation would make you think it had nothing to do with mindfulness. In combining thoughts like may you be happy, images of the people we are sending metta to, we are operating in a mental realm, not focusing on the present moment or on reality. If you don't understand this practice in the context of the broader teachings, it can seem like fantasizing, just hoping for things to happen, or even believing that you are making these things happen. Either way, you're falling into the hindrance of desire. It doesn't help. Mindfulness and loving kindness are usually taught as separate exercises, which is true. And certainly, that's my experience. On some of my very early long retreats, there was always, oh, we're doing mindfulness once a day for one sitting period. We're going to do some of this metta stuff instead. It's sort of like a balance, right? But it was taught as something very separate. Now I want to talk a little bit about my own teaching, because I think it's essential that we understand this. Like when I'm teaching, quote, mindfulness, especially when I'm leading a mindfulness retreat, and you're caught in some place where you're stuck with some unwholesome story repeating itself over and over and over, which we're all familiar with these stories. We all have them. you know what I'm talking about. But we're sort of like, we feel stuck in this place. Sometimes, instead of continuing just to be mindful and like, I'm just going to sit here and let myself be battered by this story yet again. Instead, it's sometimes quite skillful to sort of step back and actually, because all these stories have a main character, whether it's you or someone else who's the, quote, bad guy, there's always some level of that going on. And you can simply just pause, stop practicing mindfulness, and offer metta to that person or to yourself. Offering metta to someone who you're caught in this story of ill will about them, but then you instead just start offering thoughts of loving kindness towards them, changes the story. It's like changing the channel on the TV. Like you just hit the clicker. And sometimes this can be a very skillful thing to do. And then, because, oh, wait, I'm practicing mindfulness. That's my main thing here. At a certain point, that the energy of that story is dissipated by the mindfulness, by the metta practice, or calmed down. And then you can go back to being mindful, maybe even mindful of the story itself, but now being able to sort of hold it without being caught up in it and obsessed by it. And similarly, when I'm teaching metta, and people are getting distracted by some persistent story, I advise people to go, oh, wait, stop, just stop saying those phrases. Stop practicing metta and actually tune in at the level of mindfulness. You know, drop into your body, tune into how the story, what's going on here, what does it feel like, you know, and just be mindful for a little while until that you're not gripped by that story. It isn't sort of filling your mind and stopping you from saying this essentially, or stopping to have any energy in the phrases. And then go back and start the phrases again. So you can sort of they balance each other and can actually be embedded in each other in practice, as a, even in the midst of very formal practices. And I think this can become very useful way to balance out both mindfulness and metta as a formal practice, to understand that at its times it's skillful to sort of switch gears, change the channel for a little while, and then go back. It just seems to work quite well for the people I've talked to about this. Now, there's another, a little more Kevin Griffin here. Many teachers point out that a mind that is awake and aware, grounded in mindfulness, is naturally loving and kind. Joseph Goldstein's mindfulness says that our minds become more open and less defensive. We begin to experience metta as a basic quality of awareness. Loving kindness arises out of naturally arises out of just being more focused and aware. As the Buddha teaches, if we remove ill will, what is left isn't a neutral state, but a loving one. Metta cannot come to fruition without mindfulness. Just as mindfulness lacking metta is dry and chill. While our mind's tendency to categorize seeks clear distinctions, these two qualities and practices intermingle in a way that makes them essentially inseparable. Essentially inseparable. Chitta, mind. They're just two aspects of the same thing. They're just another image I like to use when I'm talking about this is imagine the practice sphere is a house. It's got two doors, a front door and a back door. Well, you come in the front door, you come in the back door. Two totally different ways of entering this sphere of practice. When you get to the middle of the house, it's the same place. There's just two different ways to get there. And certainly in my experience of doing intensive practice in both of these forms, you know, long month, 6 week long retreats of nothing but, you end up in a very essentially the same place. The mind, the stillness of mind, the focus of mind is the same, feels the same, the experience is the same in both cases. It's just ways of getting there. And sometimes one works better than the other because that's what we need in our life at the moment, as I mentioned earlier. Okay. One more thought. And that's, I'd never, this was a wholly new thing to me when I encountered it. This is the idea that metta and dealing with loss are quite intimately related. And part of this, Sylvia talks in her book, talks a lot about how it's sort of natural to feel love that for those whom we're connected to, you know, our parents, our siblings, our partners, some close co-workers, who know, friends, you know. But it's so natural that we all experience loss. There's no one who doesn't experience loss. And in a way that just that thought brings us all closer together because there's no one, we don't leave anyone out. That's what Kevin has to say about this. He's like talking about a famous sutta here again. The Buddha often talked about grief. In another famous story from the commentaries, a woman, Kisa Gotami, is overwhelmed with the death of her baby boy. She comes to the Buddha with his lifeless body, begging him to bring her child back to life. The Buddha tells her that he will do so if she can simply bring a mustard seed from any house in the village that has not experienced loss. Now, mustard is a common condiment in all Indian cooking. As she goes desperately from house to house, she learns that everyone has lost a parent, a child, an uncle or an aunt, a grandparent, a sibling or cousin. There is no family free from loss. Insight into impermanence arises in her and she awakens, joining the Buddha's community as a nun. Death, loss, and the realization of impermanence have forever been spiritual teachers. Just as a cancer diagnosis so often wakes people up to the preciousness of the present moment, so Kisa Gotami's understanding that nothing can be held onto freed her from the overwhelming suffering of her loss. We live in the illusion of safety and stability, sleepwalking through the routines of daily life, following the dictates of society and inner craving. For many of us, only when we are hit by some crisis, shocked by devastating events, do we wake up to what we already know. Life is short. Bodies and minds are fragile. Everything is temporary and insubstantial. That wake up is a precious reminder to appreciate this very moment and the love that we can give and receive while we are alive. And this is, once again, where mindfulness appears. Mindfulness is what wakes us up. Otherwise, we just get sort of lost in this flood of sadness and grief, and we don't tune into what's really going on, which is that we're human beings. And sure, I mean, there's nothing wrong, absolutely nothing wrong with feeling sadness and grief at a loss, whether it's a loss of an individual or a loss of, you know, your favorite t-shirt. I mean, because what when you just lost something and it's like, oh no, how can that be? You know, it's okay to feel sadness and grief for those things, but just not to be caught up in it so much, and to see that what it is. Kevin goes on here, however. The Buddha didn't say there was something wrong or unwise about feeling the connection with others. He simply reminded us that these connections were fragile, like life itself. And if we expected that they would never change, we are in for a deep disappointment. One of the special elements of Buddhist teaching is how every challenge in life offers an opportunity for waking up. Sickness, old age, and death can be doors to wisdom. Sorrow and anger and fear can be mindfulness bells. A flat tire or a leaking roof can be a reminder of impermanence. No experience is wasted or useless. It's up to us, though, to make the most of life and its myriad gateways to freedom. In fact, one well-known chant which begins, "All things are impermanent," concludes by saying that understanding this brings joy. One might ask, how does understanding that everyone dies, that everything changes, that you can't hold the thing, make you happy? Consider the alternative, not understanding or accepting impermanence. This puts us in more or less constant conflict with reality. And that's the key to this, all of the Buddha's teachings. Just that line that if we're not careful, we go around living in contention with reality. We somehow think we should be in control. I shouldn't have to feel this way. I shouldn't have to, or these other people shouldn't have to go through this. There's something wrong. As opposed to like accepting the fact that this is how life is. Life is full of joys and sorrows. And if you live in contention reality, you are essentially guaranteed to suffer. There's no other way to say it other than that. It's like you're just virtually guaranteed to struggle and have problems if you live in contention with reality. And so all of the Buddhist teachings are just trying to point to that. I mean, if I could sum up the Buddhist teachings in one sentence, it's like, try not to live in contention with reality. Might be a really good sum up of things, of the whole thing. Of course, I have a piece of poetry that talks about this. This is Naomi Shihab Nye from her book, Words Under the Words, and it's a poem called Kindness, which really expresses this idea quite beautifully, I think. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted on and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride thinking the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chickens will stare out of the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. This is the only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread, only kindness that raises its head from a crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. This is pure Buddha Dhamma.